are about to participate in an exciting verse-by-verse Bible study. This program offers an exegetical, historical-grammatical approach to the Bible. Our host, pastor-teacher Bob Utley, tries to corroborate his teachings from five areas: word studies from the original languages, grammatical construction, context, parallel passages, or historical and cultural insights. This is one of the several series that Bob teaches weekly. Get your Bible and let's begin our prayerful study of today's lesson.
Well, we're going to be in Revelation 6 and 7 today. I must admit, after reading all these different commentaries, I'm a bit confused. Here I'm going to try to teach you. Well, the best I can do is try to show you what I think we can get from the text. And quite often in the book of Revelation, much of the interpretations come from presuppositions, people committed to a particular eschatological system. There are some major questions as we come to these two chapters, 6 and 7. Number one, what is the relationship between the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls? Number two, who are the 44,000 mentioned in chapter 7, verses 1 through 8, and who are the group without number from every kindred, tribe, and tongue? How do they relate? And number three, what is this tribulation period that's mentioned in chapter 7? Is it, you know, which one of the tribulations is it that's mentioned in the Bible? Now, those are the crux of the interpretation. I was amazed as I read every commentary I could find how really emphatic people are on their own positions when very little of what they say comes from the text. Now, it's obvious there's some Old Testament allusions being drawn here. And the real question is, not only where is the Old Testament account found, but what exactly is John using it to stand for? Example, we come to say, "And the Lamb broke the first of seven seals. I looked and heard one of the four living creatures say with a loud voice, voice like thunder, come." Now, we're going to see what's called the four horsemen of the apocalypse. This obviously comes from Zechariah chapter 1, verse 8. It also, there's also an allusion to four colored horses in Zechariah 6, verses 1 through 8, where these horses pull chariots. Now, it seems to me as a direct allusion to Zechariah here in this first passage. Now, the real question is being, who is on the first horse, the white horse? It's gone as far as from Jesus Christ to the Antichrist. Well, if godly men can interpret the same metaphor all the way from Jesus to the Antichrist, you know there's some kind of confusion. So I'll give you what I think the text says, how far I think we can go, many of the different theories, and give you what I think is the best opinion. I want to say again that these seals, trumpets, and bowls must be related to the wonderful throne vision of chapters 4 and 5. And I personally think the throne vision of 4 and 5 is connected to the churches that are undergoing persecution. I don't think we cut off the church in chapter 3. I think the churches set the stage for the rest of the book. And the rest of the book are done in light of the churches, not in the exclusion of the churches. Now, so when the Lamb broke the first of seven seals, notice this is not the book yet. It's just the seals that close the book. The seals really have nothing to do with the reading of the book yet. That comes later. It's just leading up to. That's why I really think that these seals lead into the trumpets, which lead into the bowls. Each one of them gets progressively worse. It seems to me that the sixth seal and the sixth trumpet are the end of the world. So I see these as cyclical ways. They're dealing with the same general period of time toward the close of the end of the age, and from three different continuing to intensify perspectives. I think these ideas of the four horsemen are things that are present in the earth in every age, but at the end time will be intensified. As the demonic intensified when Jesus came the first time, the demonic will intensify just before Jesus comes the second time. Now, and notice it says, four living creatures. In my opinion, those are angelic creatures, and they say with a loud voice, come. Now, the thing of the voice like thunder is mentioned in chapter 14:2 and 19:6. Now, the come can mean go forth. Now, King James has a little added thing here, and really it's a pretty good addition. It comes from the, Sinaiticus, and so it has some very ancient attestation to come and see. Now, some say that the angelic creature is speaking to John. John, come and see what's going to happen. But in context, the angelic creature is speaking to the four horsemen. Go, do your thing, as they ride across. So I think when you see he's speaking to the four horsemen and not to John, it changes the interpretation. Many folks say that this is the idea that John is to come and look. One reason it's so significant here is when they make Jesus Christ the first horseman, it's funny to me that he's one in a series. It's also funny to me that an angel can command him to come. And you say, well, Bob, why have some thought that this first white horse is Christ? Well, he's on a white horse. Jesus will be mounted on a white horse in chapter 19, particularly verse 11. Some say, well, he wears a crown here, and he wears a crown in chapter 19. Yes, but the crown here is Stephanus, and the crown in 19 is Diadema. So it's a different crown. Diadem is a royal crown, but Stephanus is a victor's crown. Two different ones. Well, some say that this is not referring to Christ himself, but to the expansion of the gospel, as is mentioned in, let's say, Mark 13:10 or Matthew 24:24, I believe. Excuse me, 24:14. And they see this victory and conquering as the gospel. But I really think in context, these are four of the traditional enemies of man, like plague and death and war and famine, those kind of things. And Zechariah chapter 1, verse 8 shows that. Now, notice it mentions, I looked and a white horse appeared, and the rider was carrying a bow. Now, this can't be Roman, because Romans don't carry bows. There are many passages where God carries a bow. I have them listed in your notes. Some say this refers to Jesus carrying a bow, but he said in chapter 19 to have a sword coming out of his mouth, not carrying a bow. Some say it's an allusion to the Parthians, who were the traditional enemies of Rome and defeated them so often. I think that might be interesting, a footnote of history, but it has nothing to do with the context of this passage. And it says a crown was given him, a Stephanus. We get the word Stephen from it, a victor's crown. And he came to ride forth, conquering and to conquer. In my opinion, it's a symbol of war here, not of victory. Then he broke the second seal, and I heard the second living creature say, come. And another horse came forth, red. Now, red here seems to be the idea of slaughter. Some say if the first one is war, the second one is civil war. I'm not sure we can be that specific. I just think it's another aspect of men killing each other, which we see quite often as one of the ways God used in the Exodus, I mean in the conquest in Joshua to remove the enemies. Now, notice it says there's another horse comes. It's a black horse, and he's carrying a pair of scales in his hand. That's the symbol of famine. Notice it says wheat, 50 cents a quart. Now, the word 50 cents, it's hard to put in monetary value. This is one denarius. We learned from Matthew 20, verse 2, and later on from Herodotus, this was a day's wage for a laborer and a soldier. And so it's one day's wage, and all he can buy is a quart of wheat. Now, that's what Herodotus also tells us was what took to keep one man alive is one quart of wheat. It's not quite a quart. It's a Greek word. It means about 1.92 quarts in our equivalency, but close enough for a quart. Now, notice it says that you can buy barley, three quarts, for the same price. Barley was a poor kind of grain. The poor people ate it. Some would say here is a man working all day just for enough food to feed himself and not his family. Maybe the idea. And there's been much discussion about, but you must not enter the wine and oil. What does that mean? Well, we just don't know. Not enough information here. There's been a million interpretations. I simply think it's a limited famine. Kind of like the people who are going to die in verse 8 are limited to one quarter of the earth. It's a limit, a way of showing the limit to the famine, and I don't think there's any symbolic action here about the Dead Sea Scrolls and the offering of wine and oil. I think that's just reading too much into it. I do think it's a good place where we see this this limiting is where the next section or cycle of judgments, the trumpets, intensifies a little, and then finally the bowls are very intense. Now, notice where it says, and I looked and a pale horse appeared. Now, we get in English, we get the word chlorine from this. It meant kind of a yellowish green, a pale green, okay? And many think it's of course, it says here, death and Hades. Now, the idea of death and Hades, they appear quite often together in pairs, and you can see in your notes the number of times. Death and Hades, and that's the symbol of war again, or what war and famine and plague all together. There are several places in the Old Testament that these fourfold enemies of man are mentioned. You might want to see Ezekiel 14:21. You might want to see Leviticus 26:21-26, where the four are mentioned together. Notice here they're spelled out. Kill people with a sword, famine, wild animals. And so here we see a terrible time of judgment. Now the question comes, what's happening in heaven while all this is happening on earth? And in verse 9, then he broke the fifth seal, and I saw under the altar. There's been much discussion among commentators. Is this the altar of sacrifice or the altar of incense? And there's different ways of looking at that. I don't think it makes that big of a difference. It seems that the rabbis said that under the altar of sacrifice was a specially holy place. And this is the place of the martyrs, and so I think under the altar of sacrifice is probably best, although it can't be dogmatic on it. Where the souls seem to be disembodied of those who have been slaughtered for being faithful to God's message. Now, there's many times we talk about people being faithful to God's message and their testimony. We see it in chapter 1, verse 9, chapter 12, verse 11, and 7, and, excuse me, and 17, chapter 19, 10. Chapter 20, verse 4, people are faithful to the very end. And that's very important in this book because it's written in a time of persecution. Now, notice it says, and then a loud voice cried out, holy and true. Now, the word here is master in English. It's the word despot. It's used several times for God the Father and a couple of times for Jesus the Son in the New Testament. You can see your notes with specific references. Now it says, how long will you refrain from a charging and avenging our blood upon the inhabitants of the earth? Some say this is sub-Christian. That's because they've never been in persecution, I guarantee you. When you've had your family devastated by unbelievers just because you're a Christian, I think these people are crying out for justice, not for revenge. Now, when it says the inhabitants of the earth, this is a phrase repeated quite often in the book of Revelation, and we understand it means unbelievers, okay? And you can check the notes to see how many times and where it's used. Then a white robe was given to each of them, and they were told to keep quiet a little while longer. Now, what the white robe symbolizes, I don't know. Some say rest or peace. We're just not exactly sure. All the symbolic thing, maybe victory. It can't be the resurrection body. It's not time for that yet. Now, until the number of their fellow slaves and brothers who were killed as they had been was complete. It shows that God's in control even of the martyrs. God's in control of history. God knows what's going to happen. The same thing is true down here in chapter 7, verse 1, where God holds back the judgments until the right time. God's in control of the persecution as well as God's in control of history. And he's saying, trust me, I know you Christians are having a hard time. I know some of you are being killed, but I love you and you're precious to me and I'm going to work it out. There's a purpose here. And I want to tell you that wonderful throne room scene of 4 and 5 colors the rest of the book as God in control of history. The passage on the churches, God knows what his church is going through and loves them, and it's going to work out. Now, notice in verse 12, then he broke the sixth seal, and I looked, and there was a great earthquake. Now, there are seven aspects to this. There are many sevens in this book. There are seven aspects to this. In chapter, 6, verse 1, we have seven seals. In chapter verse 15 of this, we have seven aspects of the Lamb, I believe. And so on and on it goes. Now, so here we have the end time apocalyptic language. Notice we're going to have an earthquake. The sun turned black. The moon full of blood. The stars fell from the sky. This is very reminiscent of Joel chapter 2, verse 31, and Joel 3:15, of Isaiah 34:4. And I've listed all the places this apocalyptic language is mentioned, which speaks of the end of the earth. That's why I think this sixth seal brings us all the way to the eschatological end of the earth. And I think the same thing is true of the sixth trumpet. So I see these as being cyclical, covering the same area with greater intensity, and not simply in chronological sequence. Now, some people see it in chronological sequence, and I can't fault that. I just happen to see it a little different way because I think the sixth seal and the sixth trumpet bring us all the way to the end, as does the seventh bowl. And you can see that pattern all the way through chapter 16 where the bowls start. Now, notice where it mentions here, and the kings of the earth and the great men. Now, here are seven lists. The kings of the earth, military leaders, the rich, the mighty, slaves, free. Seven more sevens right there. Now, notice where it mentions these. All the people of the earth are going to flee from God. They're going to want the rocks to fall on them. They're going to want to hide from God. And they say, well, is that an Old Testament allusion? Well, certainly it is. It goes back to Isaiah 2, 10, 18, and 21. There's also a seeming allusion here to Hosea chapter 10, verse 8, and you might want to see that. So that here these people whose God's judgment is falling on them, are trying to flee. Now, before I get to the tribulation period, the next passage, next chapter, the question always being, what tribulation period is this? Well, I must admit to you, I'm not sure. There, in the Bible, it talks about God's people having persecution from unbelievers. But it also talks about a time when God's going to have persecution on unbelievers. Now, are the birth pains of the new age, Mark 13:8, does it include the Christian suffering, or does it include unbeliever suffering, or both? Well, that's where the question is, and I'm just not 100% sure. Every time the word tribulation or persecution appears in the New Testament. Now, notice in chapter 7, it's kind of an interlude. There's going to be an interlude in the series of seven trumpets. And here's an interlude. Some say the interlude is to answer the question of what are the Christians doing during all this apocalyptic, eschatological judgment on unbelievers. What are the believers doing? Where are they? And some say chapter 7 is trying to answer that question of what about the believers during this terrible time of tribulation. And after that, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of heaven. There's been many theories here about what are these four winds. The rabbis say that quartering winds are evil. Some say it refers to the trouble mentioned in Jeremiah 49:36 or Daniel 7:2, where the winds are evil. Some say it's the idea of connecting with the trumpets and the bowls as far as judgment. I really think, again, if you go back to Zechariah chapter 6, verse 5, you get the background in Zechariah. He's been pulling from Zechariah 6 already with the four horses. So I think Zechariah 6:5 is the background here. So these four winds would be the angels or the plagues of God. Now, so that the wind should blow on the earth, the sea, or any tree. Now, what is the idea of tree? Well, some say it's symbolic for life. Some say it shows the effect of the strong winds. And some say it's just a symbol. And I'm not sure what it's for. It's very unusual. It's here. It's unusual when this listing occurs. Do not injure the earth, the sea, or trees until we mark the slaves of our God with a seal on their foreheads. Now, here's the idea. Why has God been holding back judgment on the unbelievers? Because he wants to mark his own. Friends, if you were going under persecution, being killed for your faith, it would really encourage you that God has a mark on your forehead. God knows who you are. God knows where you are. God knows what you're going through. All things are in his hand. Now, you say, well, what is the seal here? Well, we're not sure. There's a seal back in Ezekiel 9, verses 4 and 6, that I think is the Old Testament allusion to this sealing. We see it again in Revelation 14:1, where a group of God's people are mentioned as being sealed. Seal shows ownership. Seal shows genuineness. A seal shows protection. I've listed in your notes all these scripture texts where these occur. Now, it says the number of those who were marked is 144,000. There's been a terrible fight here over who are these. Well, because it's mentioned that they're the children of Israel, and a list of the 12 tribes follows, why would anybody be in doubt? Seems to refer to the Jewish nation. Well, the problem is the list is whackoed. And John knew how to put a good list. There are 28 lists in the Old Testament. They all disagree some, but they're very basic in their structure. We've got Judah listed first here, which is highly unusual. It's only listed one other place, on the camping around the tabernacle. We have Joseph listed instead of Ephraim. We have Dan completely omitted, and we have Levi included, who's usually left out. Now, I think John knew his Old Testament well enough to know that he listed it funny. I think it was his way of saying it's not literal Israel. I also think the number is symbolic. 12,000 from each tribe. That's unusual, only 12,000 from each tribe. The tribes were almost unknown by John's day. You have Asher mentioned, you have Benjamin mentioned, but most folks would think they're from Judah in our day and would claim to be from Judah back then because most of the northern 10 tribes didn't come back. So I think that's the idea. I think the context shows us it's symbolic. So you say, well, Bob, who are these people? Well, it depends on your presuppositions. Some say that this is converted Israel, Romans 9 through 11. Some dispensationists say it's Jewish preachers when the church has been raptured out and these Jewish believers are going to be evangelists. Others say it's the church as using Old Testament titles. Now, I personally think that's what it is because I see the New Testament as putting titles of the people of God in the Old Testament on the church. I see it in Revelation chapter 1, verse 6, where it's called a kingdom of priests, going back to Exodus 19. I think I see it here in the idea of the 12 tribes. The terms for the 12 tribes, the diaspora, is also placed on the church by the book of James and the book of 1 Peter. And we see that same designation there. There are many references in your notes of where the church seems to be called spiritual Israel, and you can look that up. Dispensationalists would radically disagree with me on that, but I think they're more presuppositional in this area than they are biblical. Of course, they think I am too. So you have to look at my notes and look at their notes and see which you think has the better understanding. Now, so we've got 144,000 people sealed. We have a list of them there that I've showed you some of the problems with it. There's another group in verse 9. Who are they? And after this, I looked, and there was a vast throng that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, tongue, standing before the throne. Notice we're still in the throne room of chapter 4 and 5. Now, who is this second group, and how are they related to the first? Now, this has been the big question. Some say they're the same people. Some say they're the people of God in heaven, 1 through 8, and the people of God still on the earth. I must admit, I don't know. My tendency here, because of my presuppositions in the book, is they're the same group of people. Maybe the church militant and the church triumphant in heaven and on earth. But I really think it's the same people of God. You say, well, Bob, how can you get that? Well, I think it's two different ways of talking about what God's going to do with his people. And I prefer the term the people of God, which makes no distinction between Jews and Gentiles. I don't think John makes a distinction anywhere in his writings between Jews and Gentiles. So you have to see what you think on that. After this, I looked, and there was a vast throng. Notice it's absolutely unnumberable, and it's from every kindred and tribe. Wow, isn't that... Here shows the gospel's advance across national barriers. Notice they're still before the throne. They're clothed in white robe with palm branches. And there's been much discussion here. Is this going back to the Passover idea, like in the Gospels, or the Feast of Tabernacles, or is it a symbol of victory? I think it's a symbol of victory here more than a set Jewish feast. And our salvation is due our God, who is seated on the throne, and to the Lamb. And all the angels stood around the throne, the elders, the four living creatures. I think these are all groups of angelic beings. And they fell on their faces and before the throne, worshiped God, saying, now here's a sevenfold blessing. Amen, blessing, glory, wisdom, thanksgiving, honor, power, strength to our God. Another one of these hymns. We saw some back in chapter 4. We saw some in chapter 5. Here we have some in chapter 7 that shows we're in one literary context. We only have to break it up because of our misunderstanding, the author's intent. But it's one flowing vision to him, one flowing truth. Now, and I answered and said, one of the elders said, who is this? And John says, oh, I don't know. You know, sir, tell me. And the very fact he calls him sir is another reason why I think the elders are angels, because that's the common way to refer to angels, the book of Daniel and such. He said to me, these are the people who are coming through the great tribulation. Oh, my, what great tribulation is this? Well, that's the fight. Is it the unbelievers persecuting the church? Is it God persecuting the unbelievers? Is it both of them? Is it the setting of John's day where some of those seven churches were under persecution? Is it the setting of Domitian and Nero and Rome? Is it the persecution in every age that'll be intensified at the end? Yes, on all of them. I think you can't pin it down a whole lot closer than that. They washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. What an unusual metaphor. Made them white in the blood of the Lamb. But that is the gospel, that in Christ's death we have righteousness. It is in his substitutionary atonement that we are made whole. And that's the truth of the gospel. Now, notice it says then, and it's why they before the throne of God day and night serve him in his temple, and he who is seated on his throne will shelter them in his tent. This is the root Shekinah, to dwell permanently. What an encouraging word. People being hurt, but saying God's going to dwell with you permanently. Even though in the midst of these tribulations and pressures and some are dying, God's on his throne. God knows them. God's protecting them. That's the thrust here. Even if I've misinterpreted who the 144,000 are and the innumerable hosts from every tribe, the major thrust here is the sovereignty of God over history, not details of the second coming. We have truth here, but it's in symbolic language. It's drawing from Old Testament allusions and then changing them some. So I don't think we can be real dogmatic. And the purpose of the book is not that we understand every symbol. If that was the purpose, we have godly men disagreeing 180 degrees on interpretations. It's not, the focus is not in on the true interpretation of the symbols. but the overall thrust that this is happening before the throne of God. God's in control. God's going to work it out. Justice is going to come. Justice for unbelievers, justice for believers. Wow, I tell you what, there's the truth. Now, notice it says, there'll be no more hungry and thirsty. Oh, the allusions here to the idea of God setting things straight, being with His people. Notice here, the Lamb who's the center of the throne will be a shepherd. Here is the beautiful message of John 10, Jesus the Good Shepherd with His people. Not will wipe away every tear from their eye. Goes back to Isaiah 25:8, and is quoted again in Revelation 21:4, where it all comes together. Now, my personal opinion is that chapter 8, verse 1 is the content of the seventh seal, a quietness. There's a quietness in heaven. You say, well, why? Well, there are many theories about this quietness, and I've listed them in your notes. Some say it means this and this and this. We're not sure. But I think that's the content of the seventh seal. Now, some say the seventh seal is really the seven trumpets. And some say the seventh trumpet is really the seven bowls. Here we have a picture of a persecuted church. We have a vision of God on His throne, and God's mechanism for redeeming mankind, a lamb that was slain. And the only one who can open the book of the world history or the destiny of man is this lamb. And as He opens the book, He hadn't got to the book yet, all these plagues begin to fall on humanity. In the midst of these plagues, we see that God is in control. God does know His people. He's got them marked and sealed. And there's going to be a huge group of saved people there. A huge group from every kindred and tribe there. Friend, that's the word. That's the message. That's the great truth. Not the details of this apocalyptic language, because we all disagree on the details. But the overall theme is sure. Our God reigns. Hallelujah. See you again, same time, same place next week.